Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
This week, we are sitting down with Asher McClanahan, the new head of games at Kickstarter, to talk about his new role, the future of crowdfunding, and what TTRPG creators can do to be more successful on the platform. Asher, welcome to the show.
Hey.
Welcome, welcome.
That was an incredible drum fill that you intro with there.
Oh, now we have to leave it in. You referenced it.
Now we have to leave it in. Oh, no! You referenced it. Usually I just do it for fun. It puts people at ease right off the bat. It's like, oh, this guy's stupid. I can say something stupid.
I mean, you've set the tone for stupidity that I think is very well worth carrying forward into this. We're just talking about games without having a little
fun. Yeah, we're just talking about games and, you know, nothing like complicated like business or tariffs or anything like that.
It's all super simple certainly. Stuff.
It's everything so super easy. Simple, especially right now.
It's just two different flavors of make-em-ups.
So, Asher, our goal we like to set out at the top of every conversation, and today with you, we really just want to talk about games at Kickstarter, specifically TTRPGs. That's our focus area, where they have been, where they are at, and now under your leadership, where they're headed. Along the way, we want to pull out some tangible advice for our audience, identify some pitfalls, maybe even make some big future predictions if we're feeling crazy. But to start us off, you're 3 months in, right?
Yeah.
3 months
that's
in?
That's right.
What have been your biggest focuses in these first few months at Kickstarter?
Man, that's a really good question. I mean, at a certain point, the first 30 days is a blur, right? There's like everything internal that's happening. I'm learning like the norms of the business as a whole. But really, I think my focus right now has been connecting with creators. I mean, that I think is core to what I want to bring back to Kickstarter. I think we do a good job of communicating with creators that come to us and that are in front of us. You know, we have so many projects on the platform all the time. I think there have been phases of time at Kickstarter that has been necessarily reactive. And I'm trying to pivot into a more proactive outreach. Like, let's have conversation. Kickstarter as a whole and me personally actively want to hear from creators that are on the platform, that are not on the platform, that need something from the games industry. And so that's really been my focus these past couple months, is just connecting with people. You know, I've talked to a bunch of creators very recently who have been like, yeah, it's so great to actually connect with somebody that is there because we haven't been able to consistently. And so it feels really good to be able to be in that position where I can communicate with creators and hear from them about what works, what's not working. And so right now, that's really what I'm living in, just listening.
Within those first like early conversations, have there been any commonalities between what is working, what isn't working, what creators are asking for?
I mean, the sort of elephant in the room has for a long time, since my last campaign in 2023 for sure, has been Pledge Manager, right? Like that's such a huge thing for backer experience streamlining. It's like those creators that really deeply care about the backer experience, beyond just the gameplay experience, but sort of the experience that they are providing to people who are supporting them, a Pledge Manager where it is all in one and seamless, and I don't have to send my backers to another platform so that they can learn a new mode that they must interact with me in, is huge. And so that's the big one. And I think a lot of the other stuff is disparate. Like I hear a ton of feedback in a bunch of different places. And just like all people, I think it is part and parcel of the experience that they are having in that very moment, right? Like if I'm talking to a creator who's like mid-fulfillment, they're obviously talking to me about tariffs and they're talking to me about improvements to making updates on the platform. If I'm talking to a creator that is mid-campaign, they want to know how they can engage meaningfully during the campaign and things that we have planned to increase that engagement when you're in that sort of mid-campaign slump that we all experience. And then if you're before, you're like, hey, can I get this like a bunch of pre-launch features and stuff? And so they're all very disparate. And a lot of my job is working with the technology teams at Kickstarter to say, hey, all of our creators are saying all of these things. Let's talk about how we can make them all happen and in what order that needs to happen. So Pledge Manager is the big one. Everything else, it's like 100 other features. Yeah.
What So you said Pledge Manor is the big one. Is that kind of going to be the first area you're tackling? Like, that's kind of the big first thing?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, we announced really early this year that it was coming. And on May 8th, we just moved into a sort of larger availability that enabled Pledge Manager for every single creator on the platform. So, yeah, I think the big thing that we're really honed in on with Pledge Manager is very closely and very actively listening to feedback. So we're putting together a lot of like high fidelity structure on internally to Kickstarter to make sure that we're understanding whenever we get any modicum of feedback about Pledge Manager, that is bubbling up to our technology teams and our product people so that we can make sure that we're, you know, making the right decisions about what bugs need to be fixed right now, what next features are most important to people, and things like that. So, yes, that's a huge one. And I imagine that will be all-consuming for me personally, probably for the next, you know, month or so, month and a half at least.
I mean, it is the big, it's as you said, it is the big thing. So it should take that time. It needs that care. And then you can start picking at the smaller things that are going to affect more and more people.
That's exactly right.
I love that you mentioned like that one of the first things you're doing is connecting with people. And like you were saying, people had talked a long time for, I feel like I couldn't connect with someone at Kickstarter. And I think that in my own personal experience, I'm small scale relative to a lot of TTRPG folks, but I think I started on Kickstarter and then I made the transition to BackerKit. And one of those reasons was I felt a direct support from like a project manager sort of role. Beyond you alone, because obviously you can't connect with everybody as much as I'm sure you'd like to. What is sort of your plan for sort of increasing that human-to-human contact, like between Kickstarter and its games creators?
That's a really good question. I mean, we have a team, but it's smaller than most people think. Like, I think a lot of people are under the impression that the games team at Kickstarter is like huge, right? It's me and two other people.
Sure, sure.
It's not a huge team. And we have, like I just checked a minute ago, we have 700 games projects that are live right now. So obviously, like, as much as I would love to, it's untenable for us to talk to every one of those people. But the approach that we're generally taking is I want to maximize the efficiency of our like one-to-one conversations. And the way that I can do that is by creating educational tooling and opportunities to connect in a more one-to-many way. So I'm really excited about, like, we just launched like a creator academy for sort of all of Kickstarter. I'm really excited about creating more opportunity for people to learn about Kickstarters from Kickstarter specifically and from people that we know and trust in the space, right? So I really want to create a lot of education around this industry in general and like really properly set expectations for people so that people are feeling armed with the information that they need. And that enables us to go in a one-to-one sense, like have more strategic conversations that are more pointed, focused, and valuable for those people. Because as much as I genuinely enjoy explaining to somebody the value of having a pre-launch page and how you need to consider like going live 60 days beforehand and how to build that email list to attract backers and, you know, sort of all of these things that I think if you're an experienced creator, you consider a little bit more along the lines of table stakes. Like, I really enjoy helping people understand that. But at scale, I think it's more important to talk about like, okay, you did this first campaign. You had all of the information that you needed. Like, how do we now help you go from a place where you're successfully fulfilling this campaign, you're going through the Pledge Manager, you're talking to manufacturers, you're getting this thing made, shipped, and delivered. How do we help you in this meantime, this interim between products, build audience, build your business, right? Because I think that's something a lot of people miss. It's like you've made a tabletop role-playing game project or whatever. You've made this product. Now you have a business. And how does that tabletop role-playing game see the light of day beyond just the Kickstarter so that you can start to abstract out and think more strategically about the future of the products that you create and the businesses that you create? And so I'm really excited to have those kind of conversations with people. But it requires, again, those sort of table stakes, like democratizing some of the more basic information that if you've run a couple of campaigns or you're in the space already and you have friends in the industry, you can intuit or find out all of this information very quickly. And it's not that it's secret. It's just that nobody knows it until somebody tells you. Like when I was with Alchemy RPG and we were running our campaigns, you know, we had the fortune of knowing the folks at Hit Point Press. And they were incredibly helpful to us in decreasing the very intense learning curve that is creating a project on Kickstarter. And a lot of people don't have that benefit. So I really want to democratize that sort of basic level information so that we can help in a one-to-one way in ways that are more sort of like strategically meaningful. Does that make sense?
100%.
I think throughout this conversation, I want to try to pull out some like very clear like pieces of advice for both like new designers and people at that like next level. And you're talking about the table stakes. Can you give us a laydown of like, what are those core things that people need to know or like the best place on Kickstarter to find out that like base level information if you're doing your first campaign?
Yeah. So for the most basic table stakes, the Kickstarter Learning Lab is an incredible place to start, right? That like really goes through all of the basics of crafting any campaign. That's huge. I think really, really important that you understand sort of all of these basics. It's really just a sort of like how-to. Launch Boom worked on it with us, which I don't know if you know those folks. Great agency that does some really awesome work in the space. They are also very informative. They've got a great series of videos too. So I would say like the very basic fundamentals, Learning Lab, definitely. Beyond that, there are some really incredible communities out in the world. Like I left Facebook in the mid-aughts. I was like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this Facebook thing. And games sort of necessarily brought me back because there's so many great Facebook groups where people are democratizing the sort of information. And that's a great place to ask questions very actively. I think it's a question. How do I get all this information about table stakes?
I think just the like, let's start with the base level stuff. There's Learning Lab, and then is there like one or two other communities or spaces you would send people for that first bite of information?
Yeah. There is a Facebook group. It's like TTRPG Design Lab. There's some really, really great conversation happening there. The Kickstarter Reddit has a lot of people who are like, hey, will you check out my Kickstarter page and give me feedback? I do check that fairly regularly. A lot of times the advice is really good. A lot of times you need to take it with a grain of salt, but it's a great proof point. It's like another great validation point. And then I think beyond that, one of the best things about games, I think generally speaking, the games industry, what has drawn me towards it is that I think there are a high proportion of people who are in games who have at one point or another felt othered, who have felt like they don't necessarily belong in the zeitgeist that they're present in. And as a result, everybody feels sensitive to that. And they're so welcoming and they're so forthright with advice and tips. It really is a sort of a rising tides raises all ships sort of community. And so some of the best advice that I can ever give anybody is like, do you have a local con? Where do you have an unpub event? Do you have an environment where creators are gathering? Go talk to them. Like, I will actively talk to anybody who has an idea about a game, and I will tell them everything that I can in the time span that I have, and I know that I'm not alone. So I think community participation is just like such a huge part of getting involved and understanding those table stakes. Yeah. And then, of course, us, we're here too.
It's interesting because we talk about this a lot, that like that learning from community is so key. And one of the areas that we specifically talk about this is in February when we do a series of episodes on Zine Month, which is an initiative that kind of emerged when Zine Quest at Kickstarter dropped off 1 year and then kind of came up later in the year. And the community sort of came together and was like, okay, what if we make our own first-time designer thing? So on Zine Quest and first-time designers, because obviously there's once you've done one, there's so much you learn. How do you see kind of supporting those first-time designers in events like a Zine Quest or just more broadly?
Yeah, I think generally speaking, I want to use a sort of overused analogy, like really sharpen the axe with something like Zine Quest. So right now we have some resources that are available, but what I would really like to do is get some folks involved ahead of ZineQuest to create some content by people who really love zines, right? Like Phil Reed is an incredible creator on Kickstarter, and he's like so prolific, and he knows so much about creating zines. And like Ninth Level Games, another example, they make amazing zines. I don't think it counts as a zine because it's a sort of different style of book, but like Business Wizards by Ninth Level Games, like what a hilarious and fun game. and like that, I think those folks, Chris and Heather O'Neill, are so good at like, first of all, they'll democratize as much information as they possibly can for you, which I love, but they also just understand how to encourage people to make rad stuff. And I think like that's the key. First-time creators just need the encouragement to know that like they don't have to feel imposter syndrome. Like you can make an RPG where you're wizards in a corporate hellscape trying to escape. And that's a perfectly valid game alongside something like Heart or, you know, Pathfinder or whatever. A lot of that first-time creation stuff is just encouraging people to and may helping them feel empowered to start. Because if you have the idea, generally speaking, and I was talking to the crowdfunding nerds about this, the marketing agency, one of the things that they said is like, it's very rare that they see an idea that somebody has. If they're building it because they want to see it come into the world, it is so rare that they can't find an audience for that thing. Like if you have an idea for a game, as much as we celebrate the uniqueness of humanity, like there are enough people who feel similarly to you that are going to love your, you know, insert procedurally generated title of an RPG here.
Yeah, sure.
The line I always love that if you're one in a million, that means there's 8,000 people in the world exactly like you.
That's really good.
That's like, great. I love that.
Right?
Like that. Yeah.
You're going to find your people. They do exist no matter how niche the idea is.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the biggest part about first-time creators. It's like, you're not going to get $1 million campaign. Well, I mean, you could. It's not terribly likely. Let's set expectations. Just make a game that you really love. Get those table stakes under your belt and then build from there.
I also want to point out that in our zine quest, one of our favorite projects was, Horse Majeure, which is like a one-page fold-up game about playing two people in a horse costume trying to find an apple.
That sounds incredible.
Like, it doesn't have to be. And that project went gangbusters for the scale of thing that it was trying to do.
I mean, that sort of irreverence is just like so hot right now. But also, I was just telling you guys before the show started, was like that Quinn's Quest episode that you did last year. One of the things that really stood out to me is when he said, I see tabletop role-playing games in the same place that board games were in 2011. Like, we don't even know what an RPG can be. And it turns out an RPG can be two people in a horse costume trying to find an apple. Like, that's totally possible and reasonable. So whatever crazy idea you have, go for it.
It's possible, reasonable, and rad as hell, baby.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, the mechanics of that game just slap. I can't get over that game.
It was a great game. It was just, yeah, it was such a sleeper.
It's cool.
So we're talking about audience here a little bit and like finding that audience, even if it's small or whatever. And I think that that's one of the things that like I've always felt like Kickstarter, one of the reasons for its success is that it's like very user friendly on the consumer side. Like it's like it has like sort of a shoppable platform. It has an app. Are there ways when you think about the consumers specifically in the games section of Kickstarter and like speaking to them in new ways? Or is that part of the equation for you for improving the platform for creators, is like any changes on how the platform interacts with consumers when it comes to games or communicates to consumers when it comes to games?
Yeah, we have some really cool stuff coming in terms of like discoverability on the platform. I think that's something that we really care about. So, you know, when I mentioned we've got like 700 campaigns live, if you're a little guy, it can be hard for your campaign to bubble up in a way that like random people are going to see it. And we know, generally speaking, that Kickstarter will bring you an extra between 20 and 40% of your audience, right? Like just through discoverability on the platform, whatever you do, between 20 and 40% of that can be tacked on. You'll get that just kind of from people discovering you on Kickstarter. However, I think there are lots of improvements to make that we're really excited to make. So when search terms come up, you know, when people are searching, like, how do we make sure that we are creating an environment wherein the people who are searching for tabletop role-playing games aren't getting the video games that have very similar keywords, right? And we have a unique challenge in that way because a platform like BackerKit has fewer campaigns. You can browse what is on BackerKit sort of at any given moment. You can see sort of everything that's live on the platform right now. It would take you a hot minute to do that here. So we're really excited to bring better discoverability to the platform so that people can find the actual games that they want without browsing for too terribly long. Now, that said, I don't know if I can speak for you guys, but I love like browsing Kickstarter and just sort of seeing what's out in the world, what kind of kooky stuff people are doing. But yeah, we want to make that sort of searchability and browsability much better this year. And I think we're planning on doing that in the latter half of the year.
I'm curious as to what you're seeing now on Kickstarter as far as how creators are using Kickstarter. I'm really curious about what are the ways that creators are doing really well, and what are the pitfalls that you see too many people falling into?
If we step beyond those sort of table stakes of like you can build a page and you sort of know what goes into that, you need a pledge manager and that you need to be communicating with backers and things like that. Sort of the most common things that I see areas of opportunity, because I've seen successful campaigns have these problems too. The biggest one by far is the pre-launch audience. Like, you must bring your own audience. I think there is a common misconception, especially across first-time creators, that have very lofty goals, right? Like, if you're ready to do just like $1,000, $2,000, a couple hundred backers, like, we can help you discover that number of backers. But if you're coming in and you're like, I want to do a $100,000, a $200,000, $5 million Kickstarter, you have to understand that, again, Kickstarter is only going to bring you 20 to 40% of those backers. You have to build that audience beforehand, and that can take a really long time. And you have to make very conscious decisions about where you funnel those audiences. Like, I've seen a lot of new creators understand that they have to build an audience, but what they end up doing is posting on Facebook and creating a little Facebook community and building an email list and building the launch page and getting followers over there. And you sort of have these, you end up with like multiple disparate channels. And as a small creator, you're spread super thin across all of those. Like, you want to meaningfully interact with all of them, but it's really hard when you're having to respond to Facebook comments. And then you have a Discord with like three people who are constantly talking to you. And then you have an email list that you need to keep warm. It's tough. So what I tell people, generally speaking, is like, when you're building an audience, pick one lane. Like, the Notify Me page on Kickstarter, we know converts very, very well. So just use that and then find one or two channels that gain traction for you. If that's posting on Reddit every day, somebody like Limithron or the Griffin Saddlebag, really great. They started by just posting on Reddit very regularly. A great place to build an audience and then funnel them to a Patreon or the Kickstarter page. Post on Facebook, but every link goes to that Kickstarter pre-launch page. Like, just pick one kind of place where everybody ends up. The other thing that I see all creators do, generally speaking, is wait until the last minute to figure out what their pricing psychology is. If you've made a couple campaigns, you know how this all works. If you haven't, and you're just like a lover of tabletop role-playing games, this could feel, I don't know, maybe like overly intentional, but I think it's really important to build value for your backers, right? This is like your first opportunity to sell this thing that you have in the world. And I think a lot of people just look at some other campaigns and they say, okay, $29 or $59, or I'm going to sell this for $100. And they don't really think about what is going into that value proposition. And so what I like to say is, like, as a creator, when you're figuring out what your tiers are, you'll have a series of rewards that you want to offer. There's like sort of the core product, and maybe there's like a couple of extra sort of accoutrements. Maybe there's a deluxe edition. Maybe there's not. I call them levers. Write down on post-it notes every single lever that is at your disposal. Levers can be physical products. They can be conversations with the designer. They can be autographs. They can be, could be a variety of things, a bookmark, who knows. Write them all down on Post-it notes. And then I was in product management before I was in games, and I spent a lot of time working on effort versus impact analysis. It's just a graph. The y-axis is effort. The x-axis is impact. So what I want to do is look in the very bottom right corner. I want to take all of those levers and say, okay, how hard is this to make, and how much of an impact would it have to the people that want to buy my game? Okay, and I put them all on my little graph here, and I circle the stuff in the bottom right, and that's the area that I focus. Low effort, very, very high impact, very high value. Because if you're running a campaign, generally speaking, especially if you're in tabletop role-playing games, like, you're a small company. Even the biggest are small companies. So, like, you need to make sure that you're not doing something that is just going to, and I've done this before, I decided that we were going to have hand-pressed vinyl in one of our Kickstarters, and then we did it again because people like, I just didn't learn my lesson, and it was really hard. So take stuff that is low effort but really high impact for people and build yourself a funnel of tiers. So we start with, like, this, the core game, and we make that accessible and affordable and economical so that anybody who wants to play this game can play it, because I think that's, like, a cornerstone to games. Like, if games are not accessible, we as humanity have sort of lost the plot. We should be playing more, period. So games, I think, should have a level of accessibility, even if it's print and play. We have that core kind of value offer, and then we just work our way up the sort of average order value from there. And we take those low effort things and we say, okay, if you back at this level, if you want to support us at this level, you get this other cool stuff. And then you get this other cool stuff if you back at this level. And then there is a point, there's, like, this inflection point where you are just absolutely gobsmacking your potential backers with this, like, super high value proposition where it's like, oh my God, I get all this stuff and this game, and I get to support this creator at a level that is, like, I can afford and really want to support them at. Like, let those people buy at this higher pledge tier, because, like, I'm a person, if I love a game and I love the creators that do it, Dux Sominum, great example, amazing board games, really cool. They just did Artistry. They had, like, a normally priced thing, and then they made their game in a jewelry box, and it's wild. It's like a felted jewelry box is where the components of the game live, and it was $200. And I'm more than happy, because I'm in a position of privilege where I'm able to support a creator at that level. I want to do that for them. Even if I don't care if it's a jewelry box, like, I want to support them because they're good people doing cool work. And I think that creators end up maybe, I've heard it called selling out of their own wallet, where they will say, I just can't sell my product for $150, for $200. It's just not worth that. People won't buy it. And what I usually say to people is, like, okay, I mean, if the value is there for them and they want to support you, they will absolutely buy it. And sometimes the value doesn't even have to be there. Sometimes they just want to support you. And so I think those are the two things, the sort of, like, building community effectively in a way that's manageable for you and understanding how you can help that audience support you at the level that they want to.
Cyber Plus Punk Overload is the first official expansion for the award-winning, ultra-stylish, rules-light cyberpunk game, Cyber Plus Punk, that is specifically designed for action-packed one-shot sessions. In Cyber Plus Punk, you are a runner, a merc, a criminal, an activist living on the edge and running in the shadows of a gritty, ultra-violent world. Infiltrate a mega prison, escape a bloody reality show, solve a time loop, race vehicles in the Badlands, or escape the Netscape. One-shot scenarios, gear catalogs, plug-in rule sets, and complete settings made by an all-star cast of game designers and stylishly bundled into three sleek thematic packs. So go back Cyber Plus Punk Overload on Kickstarter to get the limited edition version with a slick hollow foil sleeve. Just search CBR plus PNK colon Overload on Kickstarter. That's CBR plus PNK colon Overload.
The Badlands. Legend has it that beneath the dust, something old and powerful still whispers to any gunslinger foolish enough to listen. One day, aboard a doomed train into the wastes, three unlucky travelers hear that call. A runaway socialite, a shape-shifting bounty hunter, and a retired thief turned family man. Will our outcasts find what they're looking for?
I mean, we're already here. Let's have a little fun.
You really went in there, guns blazing.
I thought that was the plan.
My potions are miraculous.
I thought we were being quiet.
Oh, Stump only has one volume. Sorry.
Wild roses grow out of his mouth, having filled his lungs.
What's happening out there?
Violence.
Find out on Mage Hand High Five.
I love the phrase pricing psychology. I had never quite heard this thought put that way, but it is something that I feel like every time I'm getting ready to set up a campaign, like I think I talk out with you, Brian, as one of the first people where I'm like, okay, let's think through these tiers and how you get somebody the funnel visual, how you get them to sort of walk down the funnel with you, because it's like, oh, well, if I was going to get the game at 20, I'll get it signed at 30. I tell every TTRPG creator, if they don't have it, I'm like, put a signed edition and add $10 to $20, and there will be plenty of people who will support you just because they like you, and like they want to just throw that little bit of extra support. So I think that's a great piece of little advice, is to think about your pricing psychology and the funnel of that. I think that that's a huge thing for planning and like how you get that to a successful campaign. I love that.
Yeah, and it's hard. It's really hard to figure out. Like, a lot of people do it. Like, and like, look, I've been guilty of this. The first campaign that I ran, me and the guy I ran it with, Chris, we were up literally all night just being like, okay, does this make sense? Like, should we, like, does this price make sense for this? We had to like play with all this stuff. It's like so stressful. You're up all night and then you have to hit the button at 9 a.m. on a Tuesday because that's when everybody launches their campaigns. And you just have to hope for the best because you haven't really been able to marinate on it because you didn't think about it until it was just a little too late.
In that, you were talking about like finding those low effort, high impact things. I'm curious, are there any things that you've seen? And I know this is very dependent on the game and stuff, but are there commonalities you've seen of, this is a pretty good example of a low effort, high impact thing that is true across a number of different types of games?
Yeah. The biggest one, depending on what goes into it, but for tabletop role-playing games specifically, deluxe editions. Like, people want limited editions of these books. I have a bunch of them back there. I also know from getting quotes from printers the difference in the cost of creating a deluxe book and a regular book. Sometimes it's not different. And I understand that's maybe like a dirty little secret or whatever, but like, you're making a limited edition and they are genuinely, there is some art cost that goes into them and some decisions around what the deluxe looks like that is costly. But the per unit cost, generally speaking, isn't all that different, but it can create a lot of value for backers without costing a creator a ton. All they have to do is figure out what the deluxe edition looks like. That, I think, by far is the biggest one. Even if you're just doing zines, like getting a cool finish, Eat the Reich, everything Rowan, Rook, and Deckard does, I'm a huge fan of everything they do, generally speaking. But like the decisions that they make, their philosophy is every book is a deluxe book, basically, like it needs to be. But Eat the Reich is like a perfect example of that. Because when you – have either of you picked that book up physically and held it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I mean, this book that I have right in my hand.
Amazing. Mine's in another room because I just finished playing a game of it. But you back it and you think, man, soft cover, $30? I don't think I've ever paid that much for a game before. That's kind of wild. I'll do it, but I'm a little concerned about like the cost. And then you get it in your hands and you're like, mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Yes. Yeah. Only like $30?
There's like four different finishes on the cover alone. And they use like a neon pink instead of the gilding that everybody else did in their deluxe editions. And like, it's so creative and it's so incredible. And I would guess that the difference in cost for them, well, they do some particularly interesting stuff with books, but the cost probably isn't so much that it's the difference between like selling it at retail for $10 or selling it for $30, but it creates crazy value for everybody that owns that book because it is such an experience to flip through.
We had a talk on this podcast a while ago with the folks over at Haunted Table Games who ran a campaign for their game Triangle Agency, which is the campaign we hold up as like a go look at this one if you want to see how like a great campaign looks. I'm curious if we wanted to create like a syllabus of great Kickstarter campaigns, whether they're like in tabletop or outside of them, are there any recent campaigns that you can think of that you would point listeners to or point creators to as like, this is a prime example of someone just like making a good campaign page and thinking things through well?
There's a bunch of different approaches to this, and there are a bunch of different attitudes in tabletop role-playing specifically, of course, beyond, but if we think about tabletop specifically, like people that do it really well, there's the sort of elephant in the room, which is the Cosmere RPG, right? Like, obviously, they had a pretty intense amount of resource, and whatever you feel about the Cosmere, that's a very well-designed campaign page. Like, the immersiveness of the campaign page itself, from the copy to the graphic design elements to the immersion that they use through like color drenching a lot of the page, so great. Triangle Agency is definitely an example. They're sort of doing this same thing. There are communities of people that are very actively engaged with, I like to call them kitchen sink games, where there's just like this huge graphic with just a ton of stuff that is involved. Like if you're able, if the levers that I was talking about earlier are like all physical and you're going to make dice and you're going to make records and do all this crazy stuff, you got to look at what Loot Tavern is doing. I mean, they've sort of like created that. Not created, but they sort of made it their MO, and I think they did a great job with it. So anything that they make, which would be like Heliana's Guide to Monster Hunting, great example. And then beyond that, there's like, I call them, it's not really, it's a working title, but it's sort of like RPGs masquerading as board games. Sort of like Mothership comes in this awesome board game box, and Eat the Reich is to be played sort of once. It's like designed to be played in one sitting. And everything that Free League did with all of their starter boxes, like Dragonbane in its entirety, not even the starter box, the starter set is a box set. And that really helps. That's product design. But the way that they message in the campaign is really great. Non-tabletop role-playing game that just ended is Autonomica, is another great example of somebody who increased immersion with very simple elements of their campaign. So that is a publisher by the name of Crytivo. They made some other video games like Universe Sim, but Autonomica, it's a cool game, but their creative is really great. The thing that I want creators to take away from that campaign, they did this really simple thing where every single header has a graphical element, which is fairly common, but they're all vaguely and in very minor ways different from one another. And it gives that, it's like little pieces of paper taped onto a small like metal backdrop, if I'm remembering correctly. And it sort of looks like the headers are just sort of slapped onto these like products or this machine. And it really creates a sense of immersion that gets people more engaged in the world that they are selling on their campaign, in their game. And I think that is the thing that is really important that campaigns do really well, is just create the environment that makes you feel like you want to play the game. And that takes a lot of forethought.
I'm looking at this campaign now for Autonomica, and it's interesting because it is, if you just like scroll, you're going to be scrolling for a very long time, just
such
a bunch of information.
Page. Yeah.
But you're right. There is like so much stuff in it that I don't mind that necessarily. Like I might not get to the bottom, but I'm prompted to keep going because there are like, there's new things to look at and like new little bits of text where I'm like, okay, I'll keep going. Oh, now it's about customization style. Okay, that's cool. Now, oh, what do relationships look like in this game? and just kind of getting you, feeding you to the next bit so you get further and further down the page and get closer and closer to finding out this is something you want to back.
And pages like that that are super long, I mean, I don't necessarily think that that is something that everybody should do, but if you have the creative assets, it's really helpful to continually make, you know, assert your unique selling proposition header after header, because at some point, if you're getting those people to continue to scroll, odds are higher, the longer they scroll, they're going to find something that they connect with. And they say, all right, you know what? This is the thing. I really want this in my game.
That is the real thing of like giving people as many opportunities to connect with your project as possible.
Yes. Or at least understanding what they will connect with, right? Like if you're a first-time creator and you're making a zine, it's unlikely that you have a ton of creative assets. You might not even be a graphic designer. Like you might just be a game designer and you have to hire out for layout and for a couple of pieces of art. And you probably don't have, you can't just like fill the book or the zine with 20, 30 pieces of art, right? You have to be creative with your creative. And so, you know, nobody really wants to scroll through just a wall of nothing but text. So use the creative assets you have, reuse them wherever you can, but understand when you're saying too much.
There's like a wish list item as a creator that I'm always curious why
it.
Platforms don't ever do. Where like the, you know, this kind of page, Autonomica Triangle Agency, I feel like has become more and more popular, especially in TTRPGs. It's the way I make campaigns now. Like I'm always like laying out the visuals where I want it to feel like you're looking at the game. Is there a reason, or is it in a plan or a thought of like making those pages more customizable in platform? Because one of the things you end up having to do, and anybody who's made a page knows this, is that you end up making your text layout images out here, and then you bring them into the platform and you have to like hyperlink them and stuff like that, or use images as headers. And that's great. And I think for a certain level of customization, you need that. But is there any thought to like giving more in platform, just like font customization or coloring customization or things like that?
It's a really great question. I have recorded that feedback from a couple of other creators, and I am advocating for something along those lines. I think where it starts to get tricky is, and this is just coming from like, I'm pulling out my like software days. It's like Kickstarter just had its 16th anniversary, right? We have recently improved it's called WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get is the style of editor that the Kickstarter page is. And every platform, it's like they're called WYSIWYG editors. And WYSIWYG editors are more complicated than you think to change. And like, I think there's room to talk about like customizable fonts and things like that. The issue, I don't want to call it an issue, the struggle that we consistently have as a platform is we have so many needs that are on the table. So we understand there's like this industry standard that you're probably going to make everything an image anyway, especially if you're a more advanced creator. Like when you make the whole page an image, you can do really cool stuff, like have like a paper aesthetic in the background or like a leather aesthetic in the background, which we'll never be able to do in a WYSIWYG way. And like, how do we gauge that against increasing transparency for backers looking to hedge their bets with a creator who's established but maybe has an unfulfilled campaign, like backer trust, or against something that is maybe more prescient to creators that like is like some meaningful way, I'm just making this up, don't get excited anybody, that is like, you know, making upsells easier so that their revenue is higher at the end of the campaign, or, you know, an easier way to engage with creators and backers in comment sections or things like that, right? So there's all of these different levers that we can pull at Kickstarter, and it's all about making sure that every single thing that we do is creator first and like very focused and backer first, right? It's like there's nice to haves, but like what is really going to drive value for the people that use the platform? And I think something like a WYSIWYG editor, like improving that thing is really amazing. And I think we should, and I hope that we do. But I think prioritizing it can be a challenge, especially when we are up against pledge manager.
Like, yeah, more corny.
It's, do you want to streamline your fulfillment, or do you want, you know, to do your whole campaign page in Comic Sans? I don't.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
So, Asher, I know after talking to a lot of tabletop creators on this show and outside of this show, a lot of the reason people migrated away from Kickstarter was because of their policies around artificial intelligence, specifically in projects. To those people who have left Kickstarter, I mean, what would you say to them that might make them feel more comfortable to come back to Kickstarter for the next project?
Oh, it's a really great question. And it's a really hard question, especially as a multi-category platform. Right? Like, as Kickstarter, we also have technology products, and AI is a non-trivial part of it. Non-generative AI is sort of an important facet of a lot of technology products today. But sort of what I'll say particularly about Gen AI, which I understand is the sort of elephant in the room, generative AI raises very, very real concerns in creative community. I and lots of people that I know in games have very strong opinions about it. We share those concerns. Like, as an organization whose mission is to uplift creative projects, of course it's a genuine concern of ours. We absolutely don't want a world where there is like a replacement of human creativity with technology. That said, sort of our goal when we sort of came up with this policy was to generate a stance that was sort of shaped by what we had heard from the community. And when we asked creators and backers, I think that's a really important facet, is that like we have two sets of users. We have creators and we have backers. When we ask everybody and we take that feedback in aggregate, the through line that we see is transparency. Nobody wants a creation that is AI that is masquerading as anything but. There are backers in the space that are maybe more receptive, right? So, like, we just want to make it abundantly clear to backers whether or not they are backing an AI project. And that is what we have heard is the sort of most important thing, is like high levels of transparency.
Just talking about that transparency, where Kickstarter is at now and where Kickstarter is looking at going forward for both backers and creators, what are the things they should be looking for on project pages that give them the clear signpost that, like, hey, this does or does not have generative AI, and so they can navigate the platform properly?
Yeah, I mean, we have a disclosure page specifically. Like, we have a disclosure section. When a creator goes and fills out a project, there is a required disclosure section where they have to say, yes, I'm using AI, or no, I'm not. And our trust and safety team is on it. And our team specifically is on it. There was just an instance with a campaign that didn't disclose, and it was a problem for that campaign. And whether or not it is intentional or not, transparency is highly important to us at Kickstarter and to the community as a whole. So that disclosure is huge. And like, it's also worth noting that projects that use fully generative AI, like where the whole project is just Gen AI, is not accepted on the platform. You cannot run a campaign where there is nothing but generative AI. If generative AI sort of comes into the picture, that is what you need to disclose, and that backers can make a decision about whether or not they want to support that.
I think I want to underline there for folks listening for concern that disclosure is checked. It's not just an honor system, is what you're saying, that there is like trust and safety that is looking into when these disclosures might not have been made when they should have.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, like, let's be totally real. We're doing our best. We have a lot of projects, but like, it is very often that there is internal conversation about like, is this generative AI and did they not disclose it? Do we need to reach out to these people? What is our course of action here? And we are generally pretty swift about it, as far as I can tell. And people can report projects as AI, and we look into it. A human looks into that. So yeah, it is very important to us that our creators are being honest and transparent with their backers. Yeah.
I am also kind of like, just one more thing to kind of wrap this little section up is, and you know, tell me whatever metrics you can. Have you seen any kind of trends in people checking that, yes, I have used AI in this project, specifically within the TTRPG space? Has that been increasing, decreasing? Have you seen, like, are those projects more or less successful?
I can give you anecdotal evidence. I don't have any like numbers on hand. I think that the number of people who use generative AI in their projects is at least static, I would say. I don't think it's going down. But let's talk, like, let's take a moment and frame why that may be. You know, when I see some of these projects, most of the projects that use generative AI are smaller. There are organizations that use generative AI in their projects that are larger. But for the most part, what we're talking about is somebody, you know, some non-well-known creator, like somebody who is just making their first project, or they're just doing something for fun and they don't have the budget to add a lot of art. And so they'll say, you know, I use generative AI for placeholder images, and the goal of this campaign is to replace that imagery with actual art that is created by humans. As a result of that, many of those campaigns are much, much smaller in nature than something that, you know, is more bespoke, like the Alien RPG or, you know, whatever the case may be. So for the most part, the folks that are using Gen AI are using it because they don't have another path forward. Now, obviously, there are exceptions to that, but I would say, especially in tabletop role-playing games, it's people that are just like, I want to make this game, and they think that art is very important to their game for one reason or another, and so they use Gen AI to do that. I would say that they, you know, they can fund. I think there's a group of people who are very willing to be supportive of those folks. But I think on the whole, the larger campaigns are always going to be devoid of AI, or they will use it for some very specific, like, niche purpose.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard, man. Like, it's a really challenging – I have my own feelings about generative AI. But I think that the reality is – giving people transparency and making it hyper clear what it is that they are backing is sort of the least that we can do. But I also think it gives us an opportunity to assess from a sort of equity standpoint where we should go from here. And we're always listening. Like, it's worth saying that we are constantly listening to creators and to backers. It's a big part of what we do here at Kickstarter is just listen. And so we're always open to hearing feedback from the community, and it shaped our initial and current stance on AI. And I imagine that if it needs to, it will continue to shape our policies moving forward.
So Asher, as we bring this conversation to a close, I think, you know, we've talked a lot about where Kickstarter has been, where you're at in these first few months. Let's do a little bit of, like, future looking and kind of what do you hope for the future of games at Kickstarter? We could say in 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, what's kind of the ideal version of games at Kickstarter look for you going forward?
I mean, it is genuinely a very good question. It's something that I and my team are talking about constantly. The games industry is one that changes all the time. Like, Stranger Things, I don't think anybody could have seen that coming. And, like, what that did for role-playing games as a whole, it changed thousands of people's lives from a work perspective, and it changed tens of millions of people's lives from a play perspective. When I think about the future of Kickstarter, I want it to be a place where opportunities for play proliferate. In a post-pandemic world, in 2025, we need opportunities to play, to escape life, to explore facets of ourselves that we haven't before, to have fun, to relax, to really dig deep into a super chunky and crunchy game so that we can lose ourselves in the math rocks of it all. But I think if we, as a platform, and like me in my position, lose sight of that work, that my job every single day is to create a place where people with vision for fun or for learning or for engaging with other human beings, if I'm not creating a place that is welcoming to those people, I've lost the plot. And if we as humanity aren't prioritizing play as adults, as children, I think we've lost the plot. And so I want to wake up every day, 1 year from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and know when my pillow hits the, or when my head hits the pillow every night, I want to know that the work that I do is centered around the people who make this world a better place through play. And I genuinely believe that. And I think that if Kickstarter as a platform is not listening to understand what those needs are, then we're missing it. So I'm hopeful that we can continue to be that platform. We've got this pledge manager coming out this year, and we have a bunch of other features that I can't talk about that are great for creators and for backers. I'm really excited about them. But the second we get complacent in that mission, I think we've kind of strayed. And I'm excited to sort of try to keep us laser focused on that. So what does the exact future hold? I don't know. I hope every role-playing game comes back to Kickstarter. That, you know, we've got a pretty great track record right now. I think like the top 10 of our top 10 campaigns, I think six of them are tabletop role-playing games. But
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's, yeah, our role-playing game situation is really great right now. It's really cool. But I want to continue to be an environment where folks feel like they feel empowered and they feel connected to, and they feel heard and they feel seen when they try to bring those projects to life, because we're a public benefit corporation. Like, our whole MO is like doing right by the society and the industries that we uplift. So yeah, I feel a very deep responsibility to make sure that we're doing that.
And you should. And this is good.
And this is good.
We love people that care as much as we do about games, because games fucking rule.
Yeah. They're the best goddamn thing on the planet. And the second we're not prioritizing play, we've missed it. What are we doing? We're only here for, I don't know, 85 years if we're lucky? God, we should be playing pretend more.
Gotta be playing pretend more. Way more. Hell yeah. So, Asher, this has been a great conversation. Hopefully the first of multiple. Maybe we'll check in a year and see where things are at. But our final question that we ask everybody who comes on Talk of the Table is, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our cute way of asking for a recommendation to our audience. And if you'll indulge us as the new head of games at Kickstarter, if it's a game that's kickstarting or recently kickstarted or is about to kickstart, that'd be killer too.
Oh, man. Okay. TED, the people who make TED Ed, have just launched a game that is so cool. It's called Pandora's Legacy, and it's actually co-designed with another Kickstarter creator, Rita Orlov, from Post Curious. It's not a tabletop role-playing game, but it is an incredibly thematic and narrative puzzle game where you, like, make a jigsaw puzzle, and then you put the jigsaw puzzle, and then there's kind of like this escape room vibe around finishing the puzzle. And it involves a bunch of things that are not puzzle pieces, and like every puzzle piece has a number on the back of it. And it's like so meticulously designed. It's so cool. Love that. And then the other thing that I'll say is, if you're a creator in the game space and you want to talk to my team, if you have a question, connect with us, games@kickstarter.com. That is our email address. We all have access to it, and we will do everything that we can to support and uplift your work.
But also remember, it's like three people, so give them a second.
Give them a second. That's great. We will link Pandora's Legacy for sure, and we'll put that email right in the show notes. So if you're a creator, listen to that recommendation. Send emails if you want to see things change and improve at Kickstarter. You know, you sends out emails, he gets back emails, as I always like to say on this show.
Even if there are out of office replies, you do get them back.
You get them back. They're out of office replies.
Thank you so much, Asher, for coming to the table. Do you want to let people know where they can find you on the internet if they're looking for you?
I don't really have a social media footprint. You can find me at Kickstarter. Hit me up. Hit the Games Ad channel up. If you want to talk to me, I will be more than happy to do that. But I am not a social media guy.
Hell yeah. And we love that for you.
I wish I wasn't a social media guy. I don't need it.
And I feel kind of compelled to be. We'll see if that changes. But for now.
Fight it. Fight it with all you can. And if you want more gaming content from us, you should check out the Many Sided newsletter or become a member of the Many Sided Media Discord, where you can talk about this episode and all the other episodes of Talk of the Table, as well as our other shows, My First Dungeon, Bitcherton, and a number of others coming soon. Those are both linked in the show notes below. Rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
See you.